Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, tomorrow night, we will see Donald Trump and Kamala Harris together on stage for the first time because they're going head-to-head in a TV debate that will be pivotal in this tightly contested presidential race, because the latest polling from the New York Times has found Trump is leading Harris right now 48% to 47%, within the poll's 3 percentage point margin of error. Well, for more on all of this, we're joined by Graham Finlay, lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. Graham, lovely to see you. So we have a lot to go through because we want to focus particularly on the swing states today, which we'll do in a minute. But the debate itself, it's going to be a huge event, isn't it?
It is the biggest debate I can think of. I mean, now back in the day when people used to have very limited options in terms of television, everybody would tune into famous, you know, Carter-Reagan debates and things like that. But because this is the first time Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have ever physically been in the same room together, right? They've ever met. Mm-hmm. And because while she has some momentum, and I know that New York Times poll is causing a lot of anxiety in the Democratic Party, but because she still has a certain amount of momentum, particularly in the swing states, it's really her chance to either keep that going, to set the terms for the rest of the campaign, or to be, you know, halted in that momentum and to be really put off her game.
Yeah.
So, and it's the first time she's going to speak at length about policy, if that's what they actually do at the debate.
Right. Well, let's see what happens. But just let's talk about the structure of it, because it's going to be 90 minutes long, isn't it? And there was some discussion around whether the mics would be open for both of them throughout, so, you know, they could interrupt each other. Now, the decision has been made, hasn't it, that the mic will be closed.
Yes,
so your mic is closed when I'm speaking.
Right, and they've stuck with the format which was agreed between Biden and Trump, and that was to benefit Biden, where, you know, Trump couldn't constantly interrupt him and throw Biden off his game, which obviously we knew how that went. We know how that went, but Harris was hoping for the mics to be open because they thought that Trump could really lose any discipline he has, you know, when somebody else is speaking, could interrupt and could behave the way he did with Hillary Clinton in a way which I think put a lot of people off. And Harris is doing particularly well with independents and women for all sorts of reasons. And again, Trump's really nasty attacks and maybe some of his behavior could be more effective in putting those women off, mm-hmm, than with Biden.
But the pressure is really on her to perform in this debate, isn't it?
It really is. And one of the problems is, as a former prosecutor, she's a skilled debater. We saw in her questioning when she was in the Senate, she's a very, very, very good questioner. She's very, very, very well prepared. The high expectations for her are so high compared to someone who's completely undisciplined, like Donald Trump, is that you worry that they can't be met, right? That any stumbles by Harris are going to make her look like she's underperforming. And again, if it descends into simply trading insults, it's not clear how that's going to go. I mean, she's probably going to bring up the fact that he's been convicted of 34 felonies. And yet, if that's what the debate is all about, you know, Trump is a master of insulting and abusing people. And that could really take away from the positive message and maybe a sort of vague but hopeful policy message she's been on for the last few weeks.
Anytime we've had any Democrat supporters on this program and you say to them, well, why hasn't she done an interview now? I know she's done that one since with Tim Walz. But they'll say, wait until you see her in this debate with Donald Trump. So they're telling us that this is where she's really going to shine. No pressure, Kamala.
Yeah, no pressure at all. And again, a lot of her policies are not easy to explain to the American people, in the sense, if you're talking about tax cuts on actually ungained assets which have not actually been sold or otherwise provided, mm-hmm, you with an actual monetary gain, and it's only for people who are worth $100 million and more, you know, that's a hard sell because it seems kind of technical, whereas Trump can, you know, suggest that tax is coming for everybody and any assets you have, you're going to be taxed, mm-hmm, on. So, I mean, it is a tricky sort of thing for her to walk. She also has to run on the Biden record, which in many ways is a really good one, but also you know, separate herself from it so that she doesn't get tagged with all of the things which people might not like about Joe Biden.
Yeah, and people are really expecting to hear, you know, what her policies are. And she hasn't fully outlined that. I mean, even in that interview she did with Tim Walz, she struggled, didn't she, to say what she would do on day one of her presidency.
Yeah, I mean, again, most of the ideas are sort of general things about contributing to the high costs of childcare, the high costs of living and so forth. Expanding and protecting medical care. A lot of it is, if you know, a positive spin on the threats which Donald Trump poses to things people in America mm-hmm. want, like access to medical care, access to education, childcare, and some way of dealing with the cost of living. And so I think we're going to see a lot of focus on Project 2025, where beyond controlling women's bodies and controlling people in a lot of ways, there are draconian cuts to many services that Americans are actually quite in
yeah,
favor
but
of.
He says Project 2025 is not mine. It's not what I plan to do.
He owns it
to a certain extent.
It will be, and it'll be interesting how much she can hang it on him. I mean, they're all ex-staffers of his. J.D. Vance, you know, is a supporter. And he's talking about eliminating the Department of Education, which Republicans have been talking about for ages. But that's in Project 2025 as well. Mm-hmm. And so she can point out that all of Trump's policies are in Project 2025, particularly his most important one, the one he gives credit to, all the things he's going to do for people are all down to mass deportations. And we're talking about 15 to 20 million people by his own reckoning. You know, that's in Project 2025 as well. And so I think she can successfully suggest that, no, he really is, you know, just picking the parts of Project 2025 he wants to talk about.
At the very beginning, you mentioned the New York Times poll, which puts him slightly ahead. And you said that it's causing a lot of anxiety in Democratic circles. So why are they so worried about one poll? Is it that her momentum, the honeymoon period, is finally starting to slip a little bit?
I think there's that. I think they're worried that it counteracts the momentum message, the idea that all the other polls, which had her up 1 to 3% within the margin of error, all of these polls are within the margin of error, you know, it blunts the idea that all the polls are going the same way, whereas the polls are all over the place. You know, some people try to pick apart this particular poll and say it oversamples Republicans. I mean, in the end, this is a very, very close race, even at national level. And it's more of the poll becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the idea that people start saying, oh, well, maybe Trump is going to win, right? And how does that work? Does that motivate Trump supporters to come out? Does that motivate Harris supporters or people who want to preserve or roll back, you know, bring back abortion rights? Mm-hmm. The turnout is going to be so important. But this perception that Harris is vulnerable, that her support is slipping, they want to, you know, counter that as much as they can.
And then on the other side of it, we had heard his advisor saying to him, stick to the policy. He said this himself in speeches, that what he really wanted to do was to attack her and insult her. And you'll remember that famous speech where the audience is agreeing with him that that's what he should do. His advisors, do they still have that concern about him, that he cannot stick to the message? And is it a failing or is it working?
I think they have that concern. They saw support among independents, again, suburban women, African-American men, also a group which they really need to have on board and which Trump had been doing better with during the Biden administration. Perhaps Latinos, if you're talking about deporting 15 million people, who all of whom you think are probably Latino if you're Donald Trump. You know, that negative messaging is not, and that kind of the particular Trump way of putting it, is not going to help you with people who are undecided. And one thing Democrats have been claiming, and we'll see if it's true or not, is that people really have made up their minds about Harris versus Trump. You know, in focus groups, in polls, people are, you know, now that Biden is out of the race, they are committed to Harris. Harris is fundraising like nothing else on the back of that. So there's a lot of evidence that that style is alienating people. Now, Trump doesn't really know the nuts and bolts of his own policies, right? If you think Kamala Harris is kind of soft on the policy front, Donald Trump doesn't know what his policies are. He makes them up often as he goes. And what he likes to do is give 90-minute speeches to crowds where he's just abusing people and casting insults. And that, especially when it's attacking Harris's, you know, gender, right? Harris as a woman or Harris as an African-American, is really off-putting to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. But not to everybody.
But not to every, no. I mean, for the base, it's great. For the people who are in front of him at those meetings, he's getting the energy off them. They love it.
Yeah.
But I think on the debate stage, it's really not going to work.
All right. We'll see. 2 o'clock our time in the morning on Tuesday. So let's talk about the swing states now. Hugely important. How are they looking across the board now? And look, we always say health warning with these polls, but give us a sense of where they both stand in those important swing states.
Well, that's a really, really exciting thing, Neil. The debate's being held in Philadelphia, which is the ultimate swing state. Whoever wins Pennsylvania is going to win the election, I think it's fair to say. And the race there is a tie, right? There are some which have Harris up, some which have Trump up, but it is close enough to a tie. It's well within the margin of error. And it's all to play for there. But other swing states are really, really interesting in that, you know, Harris tends to lead in most of them by 1% to 3%, again, within the margin of error. If you look at the swing states, so Harris is up in Georgia by a very small amount. Michigan,
she spent a lot of time in Georgia, hasn't she?
She has, she's been campaigning quite hard in Georgia. She was preparing for this debate in Pittsburgh, also in Pennsylvania, so that, you know, she could go and do a little campaigning when she wasn't preparing. Michigan, Nevada, and Wisconsin. Trump is leading in Arizona, but there are some other factors there. And in North Carolina, which may be in play. And like I said, Pennsylvania is a tie. What's interesting is in all these states, there's some kind of down ballot office race, which is a statewide race, where Democrats are often doing better than Kamala Harris, right? So in Arizona, and these are all outside the margin of error, Ruben Gallego is up on Kerry Lake by around 7.3 points, possibly more. In Michigan, Alyssa Slotkin is leading Mike Rogers by 4.8 points. Nevada, Jackie Rosen is ahead of Sam Brown by 10.7 points. Tammy Baldwin is leading in Wisconsin by 6.4 points. And Pennsylvania, again, is really close, but most of the polls have Bob Casey, who's the incumbent, ahead of David McCormick. And in North Carolina, there's a gubernatorial election. There's no Senate election. And he's got a five-point lead over Josh Stein is the governor. And he has, or is running for governor, and he has a lead over Mark Robinson, who is a really Trumpian candidate. Mm-hmm. And his lead might be much more. People don't tend to vote for one person for president and somebody else for a Senate or the gubernatorial mansion.
So they're not going to vote Democrat for president, Republican for a Senate.
Right. It doesn't happen a lot. This split ticket voting is not very common. And so when people are turning out for Ruben Gallego in Arizona, they're probably going to vote for Kamala Harris, right? Even if there's some of the Republicans, the McCain Republicans, who've been alienated by Kerry Lake and by Donald Trump. And so these more successful Democratic candidates in these crucial states really could drive turnout and also results for Kamala Harris.
Let's talk about the fundraising again. You touched on this, but it's really interesting to see what's happened. And we were speaking on this program to a Democratic fundraiser who said to us very openly that she couldn't even get an answer to her calls when Joe Biden was running. Kamala Harris takes over and the money is flowing in and she doesn't need to make the calls. She's answering the calls. Has that continued?
Yeah, Kamala Harris is outraising Trump in August by a factor of almost 3-1, $361 million to Trump's $130 million. She has $109 million more cash reserves than Trump. And a lot of this is from small donors who've been really energized by her entering the race.
So this is repeating the Barack Obama trick. First time he ran and, you know, everyone was amazed at how he managed to get people who were watching him online on Twitter at the time and making those small donations. That's what she's doing.
Yeah, and he was able to overhaul the big donors who are giving to Hillary Clinton that way. And this has become more and more important for Trump. Trump has done well out of small donations. It kind of ebbs and flows with Trump. Clearly, it's ebbing a bit right now. What's happening is they are spending it. We know how they're going to spend it because they've had to buy their airtime for the last 2 months of the campaign in crucial swing states. So curiously, both are spending about the same amount in Pennsylvania and Georgia. So it's another tie in terms of how many TV ads people are buying. But they're outspending, the Democrats are outspending the Republicans twice as much in Michigan, three times as much in Wisconsin, and almost four times in Arizona. So, and those are kind of locked in. The Republicans are barely spending any money at all in Nevada, even though Nevada is quite close at the presidential level. So that spend, we'll see if that works for them down the line.
Yeah, that's interesting that they've decided not to spend too much in Nevada. They need to, so why aren't they?
That's a good question. I mean, now you have like a very popular senatorial candidate. People, even Republicans in Nevada, have said that the actual state Republican Party has been captured by Trump supporters who are picking candidates and carrying out a message which is more calculated to please Trump than to win over the voters of Nevada, mm-hmm. which is, you know, historically being a it's leaned Democratic recently. It's got a lot of factors in play, including a very disciplined Latino vote and very strong unions, which are another story of this campaign.
Yeah, well, we were talking about the unions in British politics, you know, Keir Starmer facing a problem there. Where do the unions stand in general with these candidates and in particular in the swing states?
Well, yeah, it's an incredibly important factor. And it's a really new thing for even Democratic politics in the U.S. The Democratic Walls, and especially Walls and Kamala Harris, have been running on pro-union talk about how important unions are, workers' rights, and speaking to unions a lot and getting rapturous receptions where the Republicans get the cold shoulder. These unions are incredibly important in certain states, like in Michigan, where the United Auto Workers have just had a serious successes in going on strike and against all the big auto manufacturers, forcing them to come to the table and give their members much better deals. Sean Fain, who's a really progressive leader of the United Auto Workers, had a prime speaking spot at the DNC convention. So this is something they're running on like never before. Joe Biden was the first president ever to appear at a picket line. And so they've realized that unions are on the ascent in America, even though their numbers are down. And in Michigan, that's going to be a big factor, which is certainly very close. And in Nevada, the hospitality unions are very, very powerful, and they can get people out to vote. And I don't know whether that's behind the Republicans not spending much there. But, you know, it's a new thing, I think, even mm-hmm. for the Democratic Party. If you think about back when Bill Clinton was running or Al Gore or, you know, Hillary Clinton, unions were pretty far away. 9 of the 10 biggest unions in America have endorsed Harris and Walls. Just the Teamsters, the head of which spoke at the Republican National Convention, are sort of holding out. But he's still talking about meeting, if he can get a meeting with Kamala Harris, like he had with Biden, he might still endorse.
Well, look, we'll have the big debate and then there'll be polling done straight afterwards. And those polls will be the ones to watch, right?
Yep, the focus groups and the polls and yeah, the immediate reaction will be really, really important.
All right. It's fascinating. Let's see how it plays out, Graham. Thank you so much. We will speak again on this topic, no doubt. Let's take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.